KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From NPR News in Washington, D.C., this is Weekend Edition. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. President Trump has made tariffs the centerpiece of his economic agenda, but what exactly is his ultimate goal? And fires raced across Oklahoma Friday, destroying homes and property. We have the latest. Also, Americans have been shelling out more for eggs, but Canada has not been hit by the shortage. Find out why. Plus, researchers are working to make black hair animation more realistic.
I definitely feel that it is a lag because of the focus and prioritization of European features.
It's Sunday, March 16th. News is next.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. At least 34 people were killed this weekend across several states as a huge storm swept from the Midwest to the Southeast, spawning tornadoes and widespread destruction. Arkansas, Alabama, Missouri, and Mississippi are all under states of emergency. NPR's Amy Held reports.
Across states, dozens of tornadoes, some described as violent, tossed trees, cars, and homes.
I've got foundations with no houses attached to them.
Mark Smith is coroner in Wayne County, Missouri, where several died. In the community of Butler, Tiffany Boyle said the gas station where she worked is no more.
We've lost all of our pumps. They were pulled out of the ground.
In Arkansas, the governor says recovery could take months, all from a sprawling system with winds feeding wildfires in Oklahoma and Texas, and a deadly dust storm driven 50-car pileup in Kansas. Forecasters say a slight risk remains Sunday for severe weather in the eastern U.S. Amy Held, NPR News.
The Trump administration says it has deported hundreds of gang members under a 1798 law that allows swift deportations at a time of war or invasion. A federal judge yesterday blocked the deportations while he decides if the use of that law is legal. Now the administration says the plane has landed in El Salvador. It's not clear if that happened before the order was issued. The organization leading refugee resettlement in Texas could lay off more than 150 employees. A result of federal funding uncertainty, Becca Moore of member station KERA reports.
News of the layoffs comes just a day after Catholic Charities Fort Worth sued the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. They say the federal government has unlawfully withheld more than $42 million in refugee resettlement funds. The Trump administration's attempt to freeze federal funding earlier this year was struck down by a judge and ultimately rescinded. And while federal funding has resumed for many organizations, Catholic Charities Fort Worth says their grant remains paused. Nine Texas congressional Democrats also sent a letter to HHS leaders demanding they release the funding. The letter said hundreds of thousands of refugees in Texas could permanently lose crucial medical services, basic shelter, and legal support. I'm Becca Moore in Dallas.
President Trump's special envoy was in Moscow this weekend meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin on ways to end the war in Ukraine. Steve Witkoff said the talks were positive and he expects Trump and Putin will speak this week.
The president is getting updates in real time on everything that's happening, and he's involved in every important decision here. I expect that there'll be a call with both presidents this week, and we're also continuing to engage and have a conversation with the Ukrainians. We're advising them on everything we're thinking about.
He was interviewed on CNN. This is NPR News. A fire broke out early this morning in a nightclub in North Macedonia. The Interior Minister says at least 59 people were killed and more than 100 were injured. The blaze began during a concert by a local pop group in the eastern town of Kouchaty. Officials say pyrotechnics used during the performance most likely set the roof on fire. Healthcare providers in Los Angeles say they saw thousands more patients than normal in the 2 weeks following the wildfires in January. NPR's Alejandro Baranda has more in the story.
The number of patients seeking virtual or outpatient care skyrocketed after the fires started burning in Los Angeles.
Normally in public health, we're looking at exposures that increase visits by 1 to 2%, you know, maybe up to 10%. But here we're talking about 30 to 40%.
That's Joan Casey. She's a researcher at the University of Washington and one of the authors of the new study. The researchers saw spikes in visits related to injuries. Cardiovascular and respiratory problems likely triggered by the smoke went way up too. They also saw big increases in visits for mental health issues. The numbers grew the most for people who lived within a few miles of the burns. Casey says climate-intensified disasters like these are putting more people at risk all the time. Alejandra Borunda, NPR News.
Today is Selection Sunday, when the NCAA announces the brackets for the men's and women's college basketball tournaments. The men's games will begin Tuesday, while the women's play starts on Wednesday. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Progressive. Progressive Commercial Auto Insurance protects the vehicles that work to keep small businesses moving forward, including protection while running errands and other tasks, at progressivecommercial.com.
In addition from NPR News, I'm Aisha Roscoe. Good morning. President Trump has been in office just under 2 months, and in that time, his announcements about tariffs have made news on a weekly, sometimes daily basis. He's imposed new tariffs, threatened still more, delayed, and even backtracked on others. We were curious to know, if the president pushed through all the tariffs he wants to, what would a Trump economy look like? Here to offer some insight is NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben. Good morning, Danielle.
Hey, Aisha.
So what tariffs has Trump put in place, and what has he said the goals are?
Well, Trump has listed a lot of tariff goals, but chief among them is revitalizing manufacturing.
We've lost 90,000 factories since the beginning of NAFTA. It's not that long ago. 90,000 factories. Think of that. And we're going to get them back.
And the tariffs President Trump has already imposed on steel and aluminum imports, not to mention the tariffs he's put on Chinese goods, those are clearly aimed at boosting American manufacturing. But he also talks about a lot of other goals. For example, the Canada and Mexico tariffs. He has said those are aimed at curbing drugs and immigration. He also wants to impose what he calls reciprocal tariffs, possibly starting April 2nd. And from what we know, those are tariffs that would be equal to what other countries impose on the U.S. And also with all tariffs, he has touted the possibility of increased revenue. These are, again, taxes paid by importers.
Let's talk about manufacturing. Could tariffs bring back industries that left the U.S. years ago?
Well, let me start with the logic of how that could work. A tariff on steel and aluminum means American importers would have to pay more to bring those metals into the country, which would make them more expensive. So then American businesses and consumers would buy American. It would make American goods more attractive. I talked to David Weinstein. He's an economist at Columbia University who studied the tariffs from Trump's first term. He said that, yes, steel and aluminum tariffs could boost U.S. steel and aluminum manufacturing, but
other sectors are going to shrink. That is, in order for us to make more steel or shoes or whatever, that's going to pull people out of jobs in our high-tech sectors.
Could you give us an example of that?
Yeah, so Weinstein illustrated with iPhones. If you put tariffs on iPhones coming into the U.S. from China, you make those more expensive. So then
Apple is going to sell fewer iPhones. And while that does create some jobs for people assembling iPhones, those are not high-wage jobs. So we're giving up on high-wage jobs to create low-wage jobs. And that's the real danger of this policy.
To Weinstein, it appears that Trump is comparing the U.S. to manufacturing-heavy economies, especially China. Now, it's true that China is a competitor and is in many ways an adversary to the U.S., but Weinstein's point here is that doesn't mean the U.S. wants to try too hard to make its economy just like China's.
The president has also spoken about goals like fairness and national security. So can you explain what the intention is there?
So one specific rationale for the steel and aluminum tariffs is national security. To make sure the U.S. doesn't rely too heavily on other countries for these metals the U.S. needs for basic needs like defense. But the goals he presents are often contradictory. For example, a tariff might presumably help U.S. manufacturing, but if people aren't buying foreign goods, there's no tariff revenue.
So how is the White House trying to sell these tariffs to the American people?
Well, they're saying this could create short-term pain for long-term gain. And we are seeing pain. We've seen those stock market plummets, consumer confidence is down. And look, trying to steer this giant ship of the U.S. economy in a new direction by revitalizing manufacturing, yeah, that takes time. That's the long-term gain they want. The big question for the White House is how much pain they think is okay in getting to that goal. The one thing I'd add here is it's important to stress that the White House has put out some misinformation in selling these tariffs. Trump has talked about tariffs as being paid by other countries. That is not true. It's companies in the U.S. importing goods that pay them. Right now, regardless of the stated goals, though, we don't know what the impact's going to be, but mainstream economists say all of this will have major costs to the U.S. economy, and it's very possible the costs will outweigh the benefits in the end.
That's NPR White House correspondent Danielle Kurtzleben. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Are you cooking up some eggs today? You probably paid a premium. Avian flu has wiped out millions of egg-laying chickens in the United States, putting a big crack in the nation's egg supply. But in Canada, there's no such shortage. NPR's Scott Horsley explains why.
Here in the U.S., egg prices have soared to record highs, if you're lucky enough to find a carton. Just north of the border, though, if you want some eggs to go with your Canadian bacon, it's a very different story.
We have not had any shortage of eggs. We can choose from 14 different types of eggs.
Mike Von Massow is a food economist at the University of Guelph, Ontario.
I get calls from reporters here in Canada, and they say, well, we're hearing all this about eggs. And I said, well, that's in the U.S. It's not happening here.
Canadian chickens can catch avian flu, just like their American cousins, but the fallout for Canada's egg supply has been much less severe. Von Massow says there are a number of reasons for that. It gets colder up north, so barns are more tightly sealed, which helps keep virus carried by wild birds out. Canada also has fewer free-range chickens, which are more vulnerable to getting infected. But perhaps the biggest difference is that egg farms in Canada are a lot smaller. So when one farm does suffer an outbreak, the effects are less far-reaching. The typical egg farm in Canada has about 25,000 laying hens, whereas many farms in the U.S. have well over a million. In effect, American farmers have put a lot more of their eggs in a relatively small number of baskets.
If individual farms represent a larger proportion of production, then when an individual farm is affected, you're taking more of that supply, right?
American egg farms weren't always so big. The typical farm here has quadrupled in size since the late 1990s. Poultry economist Jada Thompson at the University of Arkansas says the competitive pressure in the U.S. to produce cheap food encourages farmers to make it up with volume.
These companies aren't making tons of money per egg. They're just selling a lot of eggs.
That industrialized agriculture model often delivers. For most of the last 8 years, eggs have been cheaper in the U.S. than in Canada. But Thompson says there are trade-offs.
The benefits have been affordable eggs at lower prices. This is one of the costs that come from it, is if a disease gets in a house, now you have a much larger population that's impacted versus a smaller house.
Farmers here have lost 50 million egg-laying chickens to avian flu in just the last 4 months. It'll take at least 6 more months to rebuild the flock. In the meantime, egg prices are expected to keep climbing. And egg farms aren't the only choke points in the highly concentrated U.S. food supply. Recent years have shown how the closure of one big slaughterhouse or baby formula factory can trigger price spikes and empty store shelves around the country. So what's kept Canadian egg farmers relatively small? Von Massow points to Canada's supply management system, which guarantees even small farmers enough income to stay in business.
There is less incentive to grow because I can make money at this size. There is still incentive to be efficient, but there is not a requirement to get as big.
Canada also restricts the import of U.S. farm products like eggs and dairy, which is one source of friction in the current trade war. The USDA is looking to temporarily boost imports to help meet demand while U.S. farmers try to rebuild their flocks. The department also says it's studying other countries' best farm practices. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
High winds and low humidity fueled dozens of fires as they tore through Oklahoma's plains on Friday. As Lionel Ramos of member station KOSU in Oklahoma City reports, emergency officials say the fast flames have scorched around 170,000 acres and destroyed nearly 300 structures.
About 50 of those structures were homes in the central Oklahoma town of Stillwater. In Cheryl Robette's home, along with two of the RVs she rented out for income on the same lot with 23 others, were among the structures in the path of the flames. Robette said she and her husband were at home, and everything happened so fast.
We were in the house at the RV park, and we just, I mean, it was there in a heartbeat, and we didn't have a chance to grab anything. We grabbed one of our cats, and that was about it.
Maya, their daughter, was at school.
They came and they picked me up and they said, Maya, we have to go. They escaped, barely. I mean, I could have come home and both of my parents could have been gone.
By the time I met Cheryl and her daughter Maya, they were at a quiet but steady triage center, propped up by Stillwater Public Schools officials, collecting the basic essentials. A toothbrush, a towel, and some clothes were gathered on the table where they sat. Natalie Brown is the school district's family resources specialist. She says the town was prepared for the wind.
But not the fires. And so yesterday, as the wind started picking up, the smoke started happening clear on the other side of town, and it smelled all the way over here.
And just on that other side of town was the Robette's RV park. I drove there. The family's home of 22 years sits caved in and still smoky, along with two RVs and a pickup truck nearby. One of the mobile homes was being rented by Texans Jesus Jaime Garcia and his friend, who have been in Stillwater for only about 5 months working as electricians on windmills in the region. Once the wind started picking up on Friday afternoon, eventually reaching Category 1 hurricane speeds, Garcia says he was let off work early. He stopped by Walmart on his way home. But by the time he got there to unload his groceries, Garcia's home was already kissed by fire, as the homes of hundreds of Oklahomans would be that night. Garcia is living with his co-workers for now, and the Robettes with nearby family, others at one of the triage centers still open. For NPR News in Stillwater, I'm Lionel Ramos.
You're listening to NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney is heading to Paris and London this week to shore up alliances as he faces President Trump's attacks on Canada's sovereignty. At his swearing-in ceremony Friday, Carney said Canada will never be part of the U.S. At least 59 people died in a nightclub fire in North Macedonia this morning. Officials believe it was started by pyrotechnics used during a performance by a local pop group. And a SpaceX capsule arrived at the International Space Station today, delivering a replacement crew for Butch Wilmore and Sonny Williams, who spent 9 months in space on what was supposed to be a week-long mission. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from BetterHelp, committed to helping clients with issues ranging from relationship challenges and goal setting to grief and depression. Learn more at betterhelp.com/public. From Jarl and Pamela Mohn, focusing on civil liberties, foster youth, public radio, and the arts. And from Luminescence Foundation, dedicated to shedding light on neurological research focused on Alzheimer's and Parkinson's diseases, and supporting land conservation initiatives.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. In his first 2 months back in the Oval Office, President Donald Trump has been able to count on the support of the conservative press. But now with consumer confidence plunging and investors dumping stock, even some corners of right-wing media are starting to push back against the president. Joining us to discuss the change in tone is NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. Welcome to the program.
Thanks.
Where are we starting to see some of this pushback?
Well, let's set aside the never Trumper right. Let's start with the most important part of the conservative press, and that's the Murdoch media. There are really four big parts of that. There's the Wall Street Journal news section, the editorial pages, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Post, and of course, biggest of all, Fox News. All in various ways, some of it quite gentle, some of it less so, are pushing back on Trump on this, reflecting in the terms of the Wall Street Journal's, I think, rigorously reported news pages, reflecting their own coverage, but also in the other elements, fulfilling their brand promise to various constituencies they're trying to take care of, and also reflecting what Rupert Murdoch really wants, which is to kind of gently ease Trump into what he thinks is the right thing, predictable, stable markets, and not trade wars.
So what are they saying?
Well, you've seen these big headlines in Wall Street Journal reporting, you know, particularly on fears about chief executives and finance chiefs and real concerns about how consumers are hurting up and down the household income levels and how they're accelerating fears about what they can do. Take the New York Post front page last week. You saw this huge cartoon of Trump plunging straight down the incline of a roller coaster headline, "Buckle up, markets plunge." You saw the Wall Street Journal's editorial page talking about tariffs. They called his moves on Canada and Mexico the dumbest trade war in history a few weeks ago and sort of doubled up a few days ago, repeating the line again. And then there's a very gentle explainer by Fox News anchor Bret Baier explaining why tariffs don't really work the way the president claims, that they actually end up really hitting the American consumer. And even Fox host Maria Bartiromo, a true Trump loyalist, here's what it sounded like when she mixed it up recently with Trump's Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick.
I know you said you're not expecting a recession, but investors are on edge over the possibility of a recession this year after the Atlanta Federal Reserve said that it's predicting a 2.4% contraction in the first quarter. And of course, President Trump would not.
A what? Wait. Say that again. A what?
The Atlanta Federal Reserve.
Contraction?
Correct.
And that's somebody who goes out of her way to frame things in the best possible way for Trump most of the time. She just got an appointment from Trump to the board of the John F. Kennedy Center for Performing Arts.
And how have other pro-Trump outlets covered this moment?
I think you look at the four D's: defend, deflect, deny, disregard. You've seen that in a bunch of right-wing pro-Trump outlets. Take Newsmax's Rob Finnerty. He recently debated Ontario Premier Doug Ford about Canada's reaction to Trump's tariff moves.
How is that fair? I think that Donald Trump just wants to get the best deal for the American consumer, even if that means some pain in the short term.
There are other right-wing and pro-Trump sites that simply are focusing the blame on former President Joe Biden for whatever's going wrong now or might in the future.
What do you think the impact of this coverage will be?
Well, I think these things are both a leading and a lagging indicator. They tell you where these outlets think their audiences are, and in the case of Fox, where they hope to get the president to, because they know few people are watching Fox and the media more closely than he does.
That's NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik. David, thanks so much for joining us.
You bet.
This weekend, Minnesota governor and former Democratic vice presidential candidate Tim Walz hit the road, ripping into Trump administration policies at a series of town halls. Minnesota Public Radio's Clay Masters was at some of those stops and sends us this report.
Tim Walz took the stage to chants of welcome home at a community college in his home state of Nebraska.
Good morning, Omaha, and good morning, Nebraska.
This event in Omaha and a similar one the day before in Des Moines are the first of several stops for Minnesota's governor through Republican-held congressional districts. While Walz and former Vice President Kamala Harris won this district, its Republican Congressman Don Bacon was also reelected.
I am not here to personally attack the representative, Representative Bacon. I don't do that. They do on the other side.
Walz is doing these public events in places where the incumbent Republican House members have been reluctant to hold town halls. He uses the sessions to highlight what he sees as the risks of President Trump's federal agency cuts, mass layoffs, and the trade tariffs roiling relationships with longtime allies. Burke Torson wanted to know about the handful of Democratic senators who voted to advance a Republican bill to fund the government and avert a shutdown.
Some Democrats helped pass the budget. How are we standing up to Trump/MAGA to stop things from going through?
Yeah, well, Brooke, thanks. And look, it's, you're not the only one asking that question.
The governor talked for a bit and then asked the audience what they thought.
I get the overwhelming feeling that the vast majority of people wish they would have voted no. Is that true?
Afterwards, I ask Walz what he makes of the audience's response. He points to Senate Democratic leader Chuck Schumer, who has borne the brunt of the anger from within his party.
That room was, I think, unanimously opposed to that. I think they thought, and look, what Chuck understands and what folks understand is that a shutdown comes at a hell of a price.
Walz heard fear and anger from the audience in Omaha. Amanda Brinkworth was there. She sees a lot of value in just hearing people's concerns.
Letting those people stand up and talk about how frustrated they are is really important. Myself, I'm a scientist, and I'm worried about research funding. I'm worried about the people that work in my lab and what I've dedicated my life to doing.
Bridget Hawley likes what she heard from Walz at his stop in Des Moines.
I'm a fourth grade teacher, and I'm going to have a baby in 5 days, and I've got a toddler at home. And I'm scared about education, and I'm scared for our children and for our girls specifically.
Echoing the sentiment of the crowd in Omaha, fellow Iowan Gene Merritt says Democrats need to change their approach.
The Democrats just don't know how to fight. The Republicans play dirty, and we're like not, and we're losing, and we need to fight dirtier.
At the Des Moines stop, Walz says it's up to the crowd at these kinds of events to shape the future of the party.
There is not going to be a charismatic leader ride in and do this. It is going to be people coming out on a beautiful Friday afternoon demanding change and holding people accountable.
He says it's important for Americans to have a space where they can voice their despair. He's doing another one of these on Tuesday in Wisconsin. For NPR News, I'm Clay Masters in Omaha.
Whether it's video games or animated movies and TV, you may have noticed that black characters have matching hairstyles time and time again. Often flat, two-dimensional, and straight-up unrealistic hairstyles. And this isn't a coincidence. While advancements in depicting straight hair have been happening by leaps and bounds, black hair animation has been stuck until now. A.M. Dark, an artist, game maker, and professor in UC Santa Cruz's Department of Performance, Play, and Design, co-authored algorithms last month that animate three major characteristics of black hair. Professor Dark joins us now to talk about her research. Thanks so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
What are these three attributes that could be illustrated in animation?
So I'll start by saying that whenever you're tackling a research problem, you get to define, you know, what features matter and are important. So with straight hair, there have been certain features that say, oh, okay, if we hit this look, then we've got it, right? We've succeeded. For black hair, that hadn't happened. My part in this research is defining those targets. So the three targets that I defined to say, okay, these are essential features of Afro-textured hair was phase locking, switchbacks, and period skipping. So I want to break that down.
Yeah, let's start with the first one.
So phase locking is what we're calling the kind of spongy matrix that happens when you have coilier and kinkier hair textures. So before the hair actually turns into sort of a defined curl, you kind of have this matrix of hair that, and I say it's kind of spongy because it's sort of like each strand is sort of going in different directions.
Well, that's my hair under my wrap right now. That is what my hair is. It is spongy and it is not quite curled and going in all different directions. And then what's the next thing?
Switchbacks, they're the sort of the secret sauce for adding a level of realism. For those of you who are old enough, we used to have telephone cords and they were stretchy and you might stretch the telephone cord and it gets a kink in it. And so that is a switchback. It's just when the curl doubles back on itself before rejoining or going in a different direction.
And then what's that final third thing that you came up with in the paper?
Period skipping. So this was another essential feature. And to simplify it, period skipping is really the frizz factor. So if you think about a coil and each sort of wave, we'll call those periods. In clumped curls, all of the hairs are spiraling in the same direction, and that's what we see as a defined curl. But as we know, curly hair very rarely just falls in line. And so you'll have hairs that break out of the pattern. And so they skip the period. That is what gives the appearance of like frizzy or undefined hair.
And is it that black hair is more difficult to animate? Or is it that the research has lagged because the idea was to just start from a European framework?
I speak a lot about the technical limitations having been a long time excuse for why this work is so difficult, but I believe that the cultural literacy is the biggest component. Black hair is more difficult to animate with existing models because those models were built for straight hair. So if you compare the 25 years of research on straight hair and how far that's come to the barely 5 years that we've been working together as four researchers, I definitely feel that it is a lag because of the focus and prioritization of European features.
Back in 2020, you created a public database, and that is what's been like a huge help with this research. Can you tell me about that database and what inspired it?
I created the open source Afro Hair Library, and so that is a free resource for Black hair textures and styles in 3D. As a game designer and a media artist, I was creating a virtual reality projects and I wasn't a character designer. So I'm using, like many people, accessible free tools, and they were extremely problematic. Black was being listed as like a color, but not a culture. So my first initial results were like animals and fur. When I searched for Afro hair, then there were derogatory depictions of Black people, often not even with the hair. So it'd be like, okay, here's a prisoner and he's bald, or here's a homeless man and he's got a beanie on. I started the library because I wanted for Black people to be able to author our own depictions of Blackness and not have to set them side by side with things that look like they came straight out of Jim Crow.
You know, I obviously, I have two daughters and my son has locks, and it can be tough to find the hair that I think is representative. So what does this algorithm mean for representation in animation and video games?
Well, I'll say it is a starting point. Black hair is not niche. The hair texture in this paper is based off of my partner's hair. So this is a person that I love, right? Seeing that hair lovingly recreated on the screen for the very first time, I mean, it brought me to tears. I can only imagine what it does for, you know, folks who, I mean, there's over a billion people worldwide who have Afro hair texture.
That's artist, game maker, and UC Santa Cruz professor, A.M. Dark. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Later today on All Things Considered, the Louisville band known as My Morning Jacket.
If you're making easy money, then you got some time to kill. Go get stark naked, honey, and drop those dollar bills.
My Morning Jacket has been together for 25 years. It has a loyal fan base and now a new album. Tune in later today for a preview on your radio or your phone.
And take another listen. Put the needle on the line. This motorcycle prison with all its hard rock vision. It might take you half a lifetime.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. British Prime Minister Keir Starmer hosted a virtual summit of leaders from around the world yesterday to focus attention on a potential peace deal between Ukraine and Russia. Starmer said this so-called coalition of the willing must maintain military support for Ukraine, increase economic pain on Russia, and work to ensure that long-term safeguards are in place for any possible peace deal. From London, reporter Villa Marks has the story.
After an awkward, heated meeting between President Donald Trump and President Volodymyr Zelensky last month.
And what you're doing is very disrespectful to the country, this country.
It was British leader Keir Starmer and his French counterpart Emmanuel Macron who've sought since then to coordinate Kiev's allies. On a Zoom call from Downing Street, Starmer hosted 24 world leaders from Australia and Canada, NATO and New Zealand.
President Zelensky, who's with us this morning, has shown once again that Ukraine is the party of peace.
Ukraine's government signed up to a ceasefire plan proposed by Trump's White House, brokered in Saudi Arabia. Now Starmer and others are seeking to push President Vladimir Putin of Russia towards peace negotiations now, something that so far he's been reluctant to seriously consider.
We agreed we will keep increasing the pressure on Russia, keep the military aid flowing to Ukraine, and keep tightening the restrictions on Russia's economy to weaken Putin's war machine and bring him to the table.
That could mean more sanctions for Moscow, more funding for Kiev, and more of the intensive shuttle diplomacy in London, Paris, Riyadh, and Washington, D.C. Starmer said his message was clear.
Sooner or later, Putin will have to come to the table. So this is the moment that the guns fall silent, that the barbaric attacks on Ukraine once and for all stop and agree to a ceasefire now.
The UK and France have promised to place their forces in Ukraine to police any ceasefire. And Starmer said others made new commitments to support such an effort, alongside fresh military spending promises in Europe. On Thursday, defence ministers from several nations will gather in London to discuss the potential capabilities of any such peacekeeping force, Starmer said.
Now is the time to engage in discussion on a mechanism to manage and monitor a full ceasefire and agree to serious negotiations towards not just a pause, but a lasting peace, backed by strong security arrangements through our coalition of the willing.
President Zelensky had said on Friday he supported US plans for an unconditional ceasefire in the sky, at sea, and on the front lines. And President Trump said he too was hopeful Moscow might accept the proposal after his envoy Steve Witkoff went to Moscow.
I'm getting from the standpoint about a ceasefire and ultimately a deal, some pretty good vibes coming out of Russia.
For now, at least, it seems the choice to sign up to an even temporary truce rests with President Putin. But the conditions he's set so far that include leaving large parts of Ukraine under Russian control are unlikely to satisfy Zelensky, Starmer, or the other leaders who support Ukraine. For NPR News, I'm Villa Marks in London.
This is NPR News.
The file sharing site Napster changed the music industry forever.
It was a real shock. I mean, the gates were falling everywhere, and fans were taking control.
CDs became almost obsolete, and streaming music became mainstream, changing the music industry along the way. That story in the next morning edition from NPR News.
I'm Nora Rahm with these headlines. Cleanup is underway from the Midwest to the Southeast after a major storm system this weekend brought strong winds and destructive tornadoes. At least 34 people were killed. A federal judge has blocked President Trump from deporting migrants under a 1798 law, which allows the U.S. to quickly remove foreigners during a war. Today, the State Department said hundreds of gang members have been flown to El Salvador. It's not clear if the plane landed after the judge's order. And the Syrian civil defense said today that ordnance from its 13-year conflict exploded yesterday, killing at least 16 people and injuring 18 others. I'm Nora Rahm, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Progressive Insurance, home of the Name Your Price tool, so drivers can see coverage options at progressive.com or 1-800-PROGRESSIVE. Price and coverage match limited by state law. From Cigna Healthcare, a health benefits provider that advocates for better health through every stage of life. Learn more at cigna.com. And from the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people. At WTGrantFDN.org.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Hundreds protested outside Tesla showrooms in several cities across the country, including Washington, D.C., Boston, Colorado Springs, and Austin. They also gathered outside the company's original Silicon Valley headquarters, shouting chants calling on people to sell their Teslas and dump their stocks. The demonstrations are part of a backlash to Elon Musk's role in upending the federal government. Musk has been using his social media platform X to individually target some of the protesters. As NPR's Bobby Allen reports, one protest organizer saw her life turned upside down after Musk took aim at her.
Valerie Costa calls it a nightmare of notifications. She's a community organizer in Seattle who co-founded an environmental activist group called the Troublemakers. Last weekend, Costa woke up and saw that Elon Musk had claimed on X that her group was backed by Act Blue. It's an online fundraising platform for Democrats.
And I was like, we're not Act Blue funded. We don't use Act Blue. We have no connection with Act Blue. We have like $3,000 in our bank account. I could tell you every single person that donated.
Before Costa could figure out how to respond, Musk fired off another post. This time it got even more personal. It said, Costa is committing crimes.
When one of the most powerful, if not the most powerful person in the world, is saying that you've committed a crime, that you're committing crimes, it doesn't matter what the truth is.
Because many of Musk's fans believed it and joined the online pile-on.
At that point, I suddenly started to realize, like, oh no, I have to protect myself.
As often happens when Musk singles someone out online, Costa became inundated with attacks, harassment, and doxing from Musk supporters.
And I started getting threatening emails through my consulting business website, so I pulled that down.
Costa quickly got connected with a lawyer, and then she brought together her roommates.
To talk about, you know, our safety as a house, what happens if, you know, the feds come.
She's afraid Musk will use his White House role to apply even more pressure. And Musk has the president's backing. Standing in front of a row of Teslas on the White House lawn last week, Trump was asked whether he would label vandalism and violence against the car maker as domestic terrorism.
Some say they should be labeled domestic terrorists.
I will do that. I'll do it. I'm going to stop them. We catch anybody doing it because they're harming a great American company.
There have been a handful of arrests linked to the violence against Tesla facilities. Authorities haven't said any of these acts were coordinated. Costa says Musk is conflating peaceful protests with violent acts, and it worries her.
I took a day where I was just like totally fearful. What am I going to do? How do I respond to this? And now I'm so clear. I need to speak out and defend the right to protest. It's really essential to part of what it means to be an American.
Costa says the Tesla takedown protests are about trying to hurt Tesla's value by encouraging people to boycott the company. As an environmentalist, she admits it's awkward protesting an electric vehicle maker, but her bigger concern is stopping Musk's work slashing the federal government.
That destruction is having a direct effect on people's lives and well-being.
Musk and the White House did not return requests for comment. Bobby Allen, NPR News.
In times of great turmoil, we tend to look to the spiritual, perhaps even the mysterious, for comfort, for answers. And nearly a century ago, reeling from the First World War and in the grips of an economic depression, people around the world were hungry for that comfort. Enter two enigmatic figures, Tara Bay and Dr. Dahesh. Both mysterious, both enrapturing audiences with their mystical stage acts. A new book, Holy Men of the Electromagnetic Age, A Forgotten History of the Occult, looks at what they offered and what their popularity reveals about that period in history. Raphael Cormack is assistant professor in the School of Modern Languages and Cultures at Durham University in the UK and the author of this book. Welcome to the program.
Hi, great. Thanks for having me on.
In this book, you follow the stories of two key figures in the global tradition of the occult. The first is a man of mysterious origins named Tara Bay, and the second is a guy named Dr. Dahesh. Tell us about them.
So Tara Bay, he really first appears in around 1925 in Paris, performing this act in which he says that he can kind of shut off his body. He can't feel pain. He uses the power of his spirit to control the physical world and particularly his body. So he can stab himself with some pins, change his pulse. He can also read people's minds. But his big performance, the thing that everyone comes to see him for, is this burial alive thing. He claims that he puts himself into a sort of death-like state, buries himself alive in a coffin for up to, you know, several hours, and then emerges clean as day, just like nothing's happened before. He justifies all of this through what I'm kind of calling the occult.
And what about Dr. Dahesh?
And so Dr. Dahesh, he actually starts copying what Tara Bay was doing, piercing his body, sticking knives through it, burying himself alive, but in a very different situation, which is Jerusalem in 1929, another place where everyone feels like the world is slightly falling apart around them. He appears just after big events of violence between Jews and Arabs. But whereas Tara Bay is claiming that he is Eastern from Egypt, Tara Bay, in fact, is an Armenian from Istanbul, but he's selling this kind of Eastern image, this exotic image. Dr. Dahesh can't do the same thing because people in the Middle East are not going to take up with that. So instead, he sells this exotic Western image. He tells people that he's giving them the secrets of Western science.
You know, these holy men show up like Tara Bay, but then there's an opposition. And the opposition is saying, rationally, that's not what they're doing. Let me tell you what the reality is. Is it a fight between rationality and the occult?
Yeah, it's a fight between skepticism and the occult. Every time these guys turn up, there is always someone to come along and offer their extremely rational, skeptical argument as to why what they're doing is, you know, either just a magic trick or that these people are not really mystics, they're charlatans. Someone always comes up to argue that. And sometimes their arguments are good and sometimes their arguments are bad. There was one guy in Greece who tried to challenge Tara Bay. One of Tara Bay's tricks is that he can pierce his arm and sometimes let blood come out of it and other times have no blood come out of it. And this guy in Greece came up with the explanation that, oh, well, he's injected one arm with adrenaline and then rubbed a cocaine solution over the other arm. And that's how he does the trick, which, to be honest, seems just as far-fetched as the fact that it's a mystical solution. I was fascinated in general by these skeptics, too, because they always come up, but they never quite succeed in their mission. You know, just telling people how rationally something is done doesn't actually make the occult, the mystical, the irrational disappear, because actually it's coming from a different place where you want to dream something beyond the rational is possible, where you want to imagine that there are other worlds that you can look at and that we don't understand.
What commonalities do you see between these two men that you profiled and today's mystics and mediums?
I think the main commonality is in the occult, we can see something of the spirit of our times embodied. We can see what people are dreaming about, what people want to be true. Tahrir Bey in Paris, people want it to be true that there's this mystical Eastern religion that will come and solve everything. Dr. Dahesh in Lebanon started his own kind of religious movement in which he preached the unity of all religions at a time when Lebanon was in the midst of extreme religious strife. When we look at the people of today, maybe the wellness gurus are sort of the most prominent among them. They also represent something that we want to be true. If we eat well and sort of think positive thoughts, everything's going to be okay, even though maybe it's not.
Dr. Dahesh and Tahrir Bey come up at these points, you know, after there had been a lot of violence, a lot of death. Do you think that the need for spiritual answers pops up when people are going through really challenging times? I mean, when people are trying to cope with upheaval, they look for answers in the great beyond.
I think that's definitely what's going on in the 1920s and 1930s. That's definitely the reason why they're doing it. And I think it probably is what's going on now. You know, we haven't only had the pandemic, we've had people getting very worried about climate change and the state of the world. And it's not a coincidence that we are kind of having another revival of the occult. People who are offering you these kind of solutions to things in a world that you can't quite see. I think there are messages here that we can take, but they're not actually always good. So in the case of Tahrir Bey in Paris, he's this huge celebrity in the 20s, but in the 30s, he kind of falls away. And then in Europe, he is replaced by Mussolini and Hitler and Franco and all of these people. So the fact that people are looking for answers, the answers that we reach out for are sometimes very dangerous. And I think one of the messages of this book is be a little bit careful of where you go looking for your answers.
That's Raphael Cormack, author and assistant professor at Durham University. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
Thanks so much for having me on.
Last week, a new Broadway star was born. Jasmine Amy Rogers made her debut as Betty Boop in the splashy new musical Boop. Jeff London first met her years ago when she was a teenager and has this profile.
I met Jasmine Rogers in a hot rehearsal room in Greenwich Village in 2017. She was 18 years old from Houston, Texas, and a finalist for the National High School Musical Theater Awards called the Jimmies.
And I'm just ready to just go out there and do stuff, I guess, like work really hard.
And over the week, I saw her work really hard learning music.
Starting now, I'm learning fast.
Choreography. Go to coaching sessions and ultimately perform a solo center stage at the Minskoff Theater, home of the Lion King.
All I have to do is pretend I never knew him.
One night, the nominees were treated to dinner at Sardi's, the theater district restaurant where caricatures of famous actors line the walls, and Rogers was impressed.
It's so cool. I mean, seeing all the faces on the wall, it's just amazing. Obviously, so I mean, that's like what we hope, like one day, like our face is going to be up there.
Jasmine Amy Rogers' face isn't there yet, but she's now 26 and starring as Betty Boop on Broadway, right across the street.
As you know, I'm not from here, local legend like some here. Yeah, but now that I've come here, it's where I want to be.
I couldn't ask for a better Broadway debut or a better moment to just be happening in life. It's really everything I've ever wanted, and it's coming true in a way that I don't even think I could have dreamed.
Actors walk into a room, you see something in them that's, you can't describe it. You just feel it and you know.
The show's director-choreographer Jerry Mitchell saw that star power in Jasmine Amy Rogers when she was just 20 years old and played a small role in a musical he directed in Atlanta. And he remembered her.
We were casting and looking for Betty Boop for Broadway Out of Town tryout. And I said, we should bring Jasmine in. She came in and auditioned, and she didn't do that well in her first audition. But I didn't give up on her.
Nor did Rogers. She took additional tap dancing lessons, coaching sessions, and auditioned for the role 7 times. Bob Martin, the show's book writer, says,
I think it was Jerry who told her, you know, this is your job, just take it. And this confidence grew out of her, and she was Betty. She just came to life in front of us, and it was stunning. And make my heart go back.
The musical takes the two-dimensional black-and-white cartoon character of Betty Boop and thrusts her into the three-dimensional, colorful world of New York today, where she falls in love, says Rogers.
The story has a lot of depth, and Betty starts off in her cartoon world, but she already feels like there's something missing in her life, and so she goes on this journey, and she finds friends and love and happiness in a way she's never experienced it before.
To shout about, something to make me go, wow.
Australian actor Ainsley Malham plays Betty Boop's love interest, Dwayne. He says in her Broadway debut, Rogers not only has the comedy and acting chops to play the role, but she's already setting an example as a leading lady.
She is a powerhouse. She's a wonderful leader, and she always brings joy and generosity into the room.
Boop had its first preview on March 11th, and Jasmine Amy Rogers made her Broadway debut. She got a standing ovation not just at the curtain call, but after her 11 o'clock number. After the show, we met across the street at Sardi's, the same place we chatted 8 years ago. She was still processing her feelings.
You know, it was really wild. I was anxious. It was so strange, and throughout most of the first half I was just kind of like locked in. I just had like a game face on, and I was like, okay, I have to do this. And then by the end, toward the end, I just kind of like relaxed into it. And we got to a certain point and I was like, oh wow, this is my Broadway debut.
It's safe to say Jasmine Amy Rogers is not only where she wants to be, but where she belongs. For NPR News, I'm Jeff London in New York.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Aisha Roscoe. Have a wonderful week.
Support for NPR comes from this station and from the Council for Interior Design Qualification, whose certified designers work to protect occupants through the design of code-compliant and accessible environments. Learn more at cidq.org/NPR. From the Walton Family Foundation, working to create access to opportunity for people and communities by tackling tough social and environmental problems. More information is at waltonfamilyfoundation.org. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
Fiber Plus Internet is now available in Sandpoint and King Cove. GCI offers high-speed internet in your community at the same plans and pricing as in Anchorage. More information is available at gci.com/internet.